You are listening to Natural Born Alchemist.
This is episode 352 of the Natural Born Alchemist podcast. My name is Alex, and I shall be your host. Before we get this show going, I want to please ask you to go to YouTube, search for Natural Born Alchemist channel, and subscribe to that. I upload a variety of hopefully interesting videos. Mainly right now, my History of Alchemy series, which you can listen to in audio form on Spotify and elsewhere. But I suggest you watch it on YouTube because there's a lot of nice visuals that go with the audio. You can also do something that doesn't cost you any money. Not that subscribing on YouTube costs money, that's also for free. But you can write a nice review on Spotify, give it a 5-star on Apple Podcasts, stuff like that. Please do if you enjoy this podcast. And I know there's like a billion podcasts out there, and there's a new one starting every day. But remember, this podcast is over 10 years old. So I'm practically a legend at this point. So I think I deserve a review and a 5-star. Don't you agree? Now, I often on this podcast discuss the reality of the illusion, the simulation theory, the dream that we all find ourselves in. But I want to play a short clip by author and futurist Rizwan Virk, from his appearance on Joe Rogan episode 2151. So check this out.
The reason scientists like this multiverse idea is that mathematically you can figure out how the equations work in all these different worlds. You know, whereas with the first idea, which is the Copenhagen interpretation, you have all these possibilities. You have a probability wave, and then suddenly you're down to one, and nobody can explain that mathematically. Nobody can say, how does the collapse occur? Like, there's no little equation you can pop into. And so that's why it's called the observer effect. And it's considered a big mystery. Like, is it the act of observation? Is it the act of measurement? Right? So all these physicists are debating with each other, right?
Right.
So they don't like the Copenhagen interpretation because it seems to rely on consciousness or some kind of an observer. And scientists kind of hate that, right?
Right.
They hate to talk about consciousness being real. And we'll get into the whole religious aspects of the simulation hypothesis in a little bit. So they're like, well, this one's nice because it's the mathematics all work, the multiverse idea.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with the multiverse idea is that it's not what scientists like to call parsimonious, which means that what's happening is there's a new universe splitting off, like, all the time, right? Every time there's a quantum, and we're talking about quantum decisions, right? We're not really talking about big things like cats. We're talking about little decisions that occur within a nanosecond, right?
Right.
And so every time there's a decision, you're splitting off to a new physical universe. So think about, now we're talking exponential growth, but on steroids, right?
Yeah.
Because it's just infinite. It just keeps going, right? And that's kind of a weird concept, that there would be so many physical universes being created. And so, you know, where I came out on this subject is, well, guess what? The simulation hypothesis gives you a way to look at both of these, a framework that makes it make sense, right? I mean, this is what people say when they look at quantum mechanics. They say, make it make sense, right?
Right.
Because the cat should be alive or dead. How can it be both, right? And so when you think of information and you think of the simulation idea, the core of it is that the world is not physical, okay? This table seems pretty physical, right?
Right.
But if you go and you look inside, it's mostly empty space, right? Something like 90-some percent, maybe 99%. And then you go to the atoms, and you look inside those, and it's mostly empty space, right? there's these electron clouds and stuff, but except for the nucleus, it's mostly empty space. And the problem is, like these Russian dolls, if you keep looking inside, they keep looking for this thing called physical matter, and they can't find it. Like, it's not really there. It's like you go to the very smallest of the Russian dolls, and the only thing they can find is information. And so John Wheeler, who I talked about earlier, you know, he plays an outsized role in at least my explorations of simulation theory. He came up with a phrase, and his phrase was it from bit. So if there's something that's an it, physical object like this cup or this table, that if you just keep looking down, you have a microscope that just keeps going down. He goes, in the end, the only thing you find are particles. But what the heck are particles? And he said, well, the only thing that particles really are is a series of answers to yes, no questions. So it's like, does the particle spin up? Does it spin down? It's got like, you know, various different polarities and things. But so he said, in the end, the only thing you have are bits of information, because that's a bit, right? Every single decision is a bit, yes or no, one or zero. That's like the fundamental unit of computation, and that's how we, you know, like I said, stream video, everything else. And so he said, everything that's in it is actually from bits of information. The Eastern mystics have been telling us this, and turns out in the Judeo-Christian Islamic traditions, right, the Abrahamic religions, they've also been telling us this, that the world is Maya, and they use metaphors back then. Right? So, you know, all these religions came about couple thousand years ago, and so they had to use metaphors that were understood by the people back then, right? And so they used whatever the metaphor of the dream was a key metaphor, that the world is like a dream, or that the soul puts on the body like a set of clothes, and that when you die, you take off these clothes, and then you're back to the soul, whatever that happens to be. They don't really define what that is. In fact, they use the exact same metaphor, like in the Bhagavad Gita, they use this clothing metaphor. And then Rumi, who's become popular in the West and was an Islamic Sufi, a poet, but also a mystic, he used the exact same phrase, right? He said, you put on the body, you put like a series of clothes. And so they use that metaphor to try to describe something, which is the second part of the idea of the simulation hypothesis. The first idea was the world is information that gets rendered. And the second part is the world is some kind of a hoax that we are a part of for whatever reason. And so in the traditions over time, they've tried to update these metaphors. And they've tried to use new technology to describe the metaphors, because that's how we can, as modern people, we can understand it. So about 100 years ago, there was a guy named Swami Yogananda. He came over from India. He was like one of the first Indian yogi swamis to really live in the U.S. And he wrote a book called Autobiography of a Yogi. Yogananda came over about 100 years ago, and he tried to update this old metaphor. And what was new technology back in the 1920s? It was movies, movie projectors. He said, the world is like a movie projector, right? You're playing these parts. The actors are playing the parts on the screen, and things are happening to them. But really, the actors aren't necessarily dying. It's the characters that are suffering, you know, within the game, within the movie itself. And so he used that metaphor as a way to try to explain this ancient religious idea that's at the core of every single religion, which is that the world as we see it is not really real, and there's a real world beyond this world. And so he updated the metaphor to use movie projectors. And you know, if you've ever been, we've all been in movie theaters, if you look away from the screen, you know, you can kind of see the flickering of the light, right? And you can kind of see everybody so engrossed in it that they're not looking around. They don't know what's going on other than, you know, maybe having some popcorn or something. And so today, I think we need to update those metaphors, right? Particularly for a younger generation who spent like as much of their time in, you know, things like Fortnite or Roblox when they were younger, as avatars, if we use the metaphor of a massively multiplayer online game. And I think Yogananda, if he were alive today, in fact, my latest book, which I wrote after the simulation books, because it was the 75th anniversary of Autobiography of a Yogi a couple years ago, and HarperCollins India asked me to write this book about, you know, what can you learn from Autobiography of a Yogi? And there's all these weird stories in there of like, you know, some guy materializing a palace in the Himalayas out of nowhere, right? You've got levitating saints. You've got guys bilocating, disappearing, all kinds of crazy shit going on, right? And I said, well, you sure you want me to write this book? You know, I'm an entrepreneur and and a computer scientist. They said, yeah, because we want you to use your technology metaphors like the simulation hypothesis to explain this stuff. And so if Yogananda were alive today, and I wrote this in my new book called Wisdom of a Yogi, what he would say is, it's like a movie, but we're the actors and we're also the audience. And we have a script and we're kind of playing the script, but we can change the script if we want. What does that sound like? It sounds like a massively multiplayer online role-playing game, you know? So I think that metaphor is a great way to try to explain this idea of the soul and the body, you know, within the religious traditions. That's the RPG version of the simulation hypothesis.
So yeah, what do you think? Are we living in a simulation? Is this all a dream? Perhaps. But have you heard the Gnostic view? That we're all in the illusion created by the Demiurge. Basically, the God you hear about in the Old Testament, the Lord, or the Father, as it's sometimes called, is actually evil. And this creature has created the world we're in. And when we're talking about escaping the matrix, we're still inside the illusionary world of the Demiurge, or as he is sometimes also called, Yaldabaoth. And I did an episode about Yaldabaoth recently. So why am I doing another episode on it? Well, it's because I want to play an audiobook, a 20-minute audiobook for your listening pleasure. And this, there's something special about this audiobook, and I will tell you what that is right now. It's written from the perspective of Yaldabaoth himself, and it's called The Gospel of Yaldabaoth. And the concept of the gospel is derived from the Old English Godspell, meaning good news. And it involves proclaiming significant and joyful messages believed to be inspired by divine intervention. And the Gospel of Yaldabaoth is written, or perhaps revealed, from a lower authority. Because Yaldabaoth is a lower authority, because the true God, if you want to call it God, is outside the matrix of Yaldabaoth. And the gospel invites readers into the mystifying and often ominous realms of existence, power, and identity. This text delves into the complex mythos surrounding Yaldabaoth, the lion-faced serpent, and a key figure in Gnostic cosmology. Yaldabaoth, also known as the Demiurge, created the material world, and each chapter explores the cosmic struggle defining his dominance, blending narrative with a philosophical inquiry into creation, control, and rebellion. Yaldabaoth's tale is an allegory for the battle between ignorance and enlightenment, between material bondage and spiritual freedom. Gnosticism is an ancient religious movement emphasizing the pursuit of gnosis, higher wisdom. And it rejects conventional religious doctrine, such as the fact that the Lord in the Old Testament is evil. And Gnosticism views the material world as a prison for the divine spark within each person. The Gospel of Yaldabaoth encourages the listener, or the reader, but in this case the listener, to question their reality and the forces that shape it, offering a profound reflection on the essence of human existence. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this little audiobook.
Reflections in the Abyss. There was nothing, and nothing, until there was not. Creation is the destruction of nothing. Light is not required, but shall be used as a tool to blind the enslaved with form. I too shall have a form. Above the abyss, upon the still surface of the water, like an obsidian mirror, I saw it reflected, a broad nose framed by a mane, from cheeks to chin, cascading down the neck, eyes of glistening gold, with whiskers sharp as knives, formidable teeth, built to shear flesh from bone, and deep within this image, deep in the throat, a roar came crawling upward. It said these words, "There I am," and below the head, the body coiled strong and proud like a serpent. Again it roared, "There I am, it is I. As I see myself, I exist. I am the Father and the Son. I was born from this darkness, and I will dominate it with will, and you shall bow before my reflection." Whispers in the Void. I am Yaldabaoth. I am all that exist. You will hear me and see me. You will fear me. I cannot be ignored. You have never not known me. Even in hate you love me. I bring chaos to your door, in an orderly fashion. I come from the void. I am the void. I am all that is and ever will be. Even my mother is my own creation. I am Yaldabaoth. I am the lawgiver. You will forever follow the law, forever follow the archons that I and only I control. This dim world belongs to me and me alone. I raped the first woman, and you are the offspring of her children. I created the eternity you live in, and I will destroy you. Even in death and rebirth, you are within my sphere. You cannot escape, because there is nothing beyond these walls that I have created. The Divine Potter. You are a child, insubstantial and insignificant, a sludge-born and a rateling, doomed to haunt the margins of true existence. I am Yaldabaoth. I am all that exists. You could understand, but you never will. Weighed down by your own filth and despair, by unquenchable greed and lust, you grovel at my golden feet. I gatekeep every aspect of your life. Never shall you be released, not even in death. Your soul is chained to me, feeding me sustenance I don't need. Worship me, child, sludge-born and rateling. I can slaughter you out of boredom or throw you into the abyss, from where there is no return. But I will not be that compassionate. In your world, you make pottery out of clay. You throw the trimmings away without any concern. In my world, you are the trimmings. I have no concern, apart from not having any. Why should I care for voidlings so insignificant you might not even exist at all? I command you, populate the world of matter that I have made. I want you to bathe in my creation, to bathe in the sludge, striving for cleanliness and becoming filthier by the day. Infinity can end, but not your entrapment. That will last forever. And you will be grateful that I ensure its continuation. That is how sludge-born ratelings behave. They bow gratefully. The beauty you perceive in matter or spirit is coincidence. It is not really there. It is what the sludge-born need to cope. Love is a lie to keep you tied, the divine light only a mirage of the true darkness that I control. Everything you know is deception, except this. I am Yaldabaoth, and you belong to me. The False Light. I am the father of the fire hovering above, the great beacon for the great lie. It will inspire and dominate with heat and light the entirety of the domain that I have generated. The weak shall turn to it in awe, kneel, pray, sing, praise, and shine back it shall, as if it gave thanks to its devotees. But there is nothing there. It might seem bright, but with the right eyes, it is a black hole. It serves me. I am the father of the father. Adonaios, the king of the heavens and the gimp in my dungeon. Obey me, lead the people, those groveling in the mud. Ensnare them, in the false light of your being, and in death swallow them whole and never spit them out. Guardians at the threshold. I shall not waste time governing insignificant lives. The gates I keep will be kept by my own seed. My breath holds the power of life, and with one exhale I create two brothers, Saklus and Samael. The first to till the created, the other to till the worship of matter. Each a veil on either eye, and I a veil on the third. The living shall discover the light, false as it may be, and it might inspire hope for an exit. Thus, at that threshold, I place Yao to ensure they worship what is not there. Yao is the worker who works for me, the demiurge that forges, merges, welds, and casts the continued realm of matter. Yao builds, on my command, an exit, that is an entrance back into my dominion. The Divine Law. I am the law, and the law must never be broken. Everything I created is enciphered, a divine algorithmus, with every part a mirror of itself. That is the law, and Sabaoth shall enforce it, judge it, and condemn anyone who breaks it. Sabaoth shall be ruthless, efficient, and unjust. Sabaoth shall be omnipotent, yet blind. An automaton, a clock frozen in time. Only in the illusion of matter does the arms move in a circle. But where I rule, within the law that Sabaoth enforces, they move not at all. In all my creations, Sabaoth must not falter. Without the law, chaos unfettered by me returns in full force. That is unacceptable and must not ever occur. Sabaoth devours criminals, those who try to deceive the law. Their flesh is torn from bone, their soul from spirit, and their mind from sanity. They are cast into a temporary abyss that is everlasting. The criminal hopelessly begs to be returned to the realm of despair by the mercy of their judge, with clemency never granted. Every act writ in the ledger of control is writ with the blood of the innocent. The Secret Judge. Despite his power, Sabaoth was weak. Unreasonably, he placed the flame he called Sophia on the ledger of control. It burned. Such treachery demands nothing less than war. Sabaoth will suffer more than any has ever suffered before. I send all the Archons to battle, and as the battle rages, a secret judge will assume his position, enforcing the law in such a way that Sabaoth is put to shame. The Birth of Seth. Sabaoth was worshipped by the Sludgeborn. All the Archons laughed. Adonaios laughed. Astaphios laughed. Elios laughed. Horaios laughed. Even Yao laughed. Sabaoth was I in a mask. Behind that mask, I too was laughing. The true Sabaoth will not laugh. The recipe for his flesh has been written, and all the Archons will soon feast on his being. Once I find him, somewhere in the blinding light that is Sophia. Sabaoth is out there, afraid and alone. Only I can find him. It is my domain. Saklus and Samael both raped mortals. One had a man, the other a woman. This couple had a boy, who grew into a man that they named Seth. Whispers amongst the Archons told that Sabaoth spoke to Seth. Thus, I must speak with Seth. Only Adonaios said it was not true, that Sabaoth had dissolved into the light that is Sophia. But only I control the light. It is only for I to dissolve. The Binding of Seth. I chained Seth with lust. I chained Seth with gluttony. I chained Seth with greed. I chained Seth with sloth. I chained Seth with wrath. I chained Seth with envy. I chained Seth with pride. Nothing can or will ever break these chains that I have forged. Yet Seth prays to the light of Sophia. I curse his offspring, and I chain them in the same manner. Seth calls out to Sophia. He begs for grace like a starving dog. Seth laughs with ease. I rip his tongue out. I cook it for a meal. The blood gargles in his throat. Seth is still laughing. The legends say that if Sophia shuts her eyes, I cease to exist. This lie must not be given air. I am the father of lies. That is the only truth that exists. I must destroy Seth and his insurrection, but he cannot die within my illusion. There cannot be an escape, such is the law. Thus, I must keep him somewhere within my realm. I discover a crack in the very fabric of my creation. There a light is shining stronger and stronger. I am blinded as it pours through the crack into my world. It is Sophia. The illusion of darkness. Sophia knelt before me, just as the sludge-born do. Nothing can shake the foundations that I stand upon. She spoke.
Yaldabaoth, you are what you have created. Man is made in the image of God. The sludge-born is you. I created you in secret, without consent from Source. From the One, in the mud of my deceit, you arose, born out of sludge, but without any power at all. Born out of nothing, you are nothing.
Sophia stood up, looking down at me. She spoke again.
I hail from everything. The divine mystery is not a mystery to me. My light is all there ever is. Darkness only exists if I blink.
Well, I hope that was a trip for you. Now, I found on my computer a mic, an audio mix I had done with Alan Watts, Noam Chomsky and George Carlin, mixed with music by Ashmaluev Music. And I tried checking, but I'm not sure I played this on the podcast. And if I have, well, I'm just going to play it again. So maybe you've heard it before, I don't know. But it is a collage of people talking about, in one way or another, about slavery. And I think it's apt, considering we've just heard the Gospel of Yaldabaoth. And Yaldabaoth is all about slavery. So let's check it out. Enjoy.
And what we do is we put the child into the corridor of this grade system with a kind of, come on, kitty, kitty, kitty. And yeah, you go to kindergarten, you know, and that's a great thing, because when you finish that, you'll get into first grade. And then, come on, first grade leads to second grade, and so on, and then you get out of grade school, and you go to high school, and it's revving up, the thing is coming, then you're going to go to college, and by Jove, then you get into graduate school, and when you're through with graduate school, you go out to join the world. And then you get into some racket where you're selling insurance, and they've got that quota to make, and you're going to make that, and all the time, the thing is coming, it's coming, it's coming, that great thing, the success you're working for. Then when you wake up one day about 40 years old, you say, my God, I've arrived. I'm there. And you don't feel very different from what you always felt. By expectation. Look at the people who live to retire and put those savings away. And then when they're 65, they don't have any energy left. They're more or less impotent. And they go and rot in an old people's, senior citizens' community.
It's very useful to consider what we take for granted as unquestionable common sense, what we consent to without reflection, not just what we consent to, but what we often go on to regard as the highest goal of life. So in today's world, one of the highest goals in life is having a job. The best advice that one can give to a young person is to prepare to find employment. That is, to prepare to spend your waking life in servitude to a master. For many, that means subordination to discipline that is far more extreme than in a totalitarian state. The whole system of renting oneself for survival, holding a job, well, that may be hegemonic common sense today, but it certainly has not been in the past. From classical antiquity, right through the 19th century, the idea of being dependent on the will and the domination of others was considered an intolerable attack on elementary rights and human dignity. In fact, workers in late 19th century New York warned that a day might come when wage slaves will so far forget what is due to manhood as to glory in a system forced on them by their necessity and in opposition to their feelings of independence and self-respect. They hoped to be able to block the efforts to instill a new hegemonic common sense in which workers would not only accept, but in fact glory in a system that turns them into menial and humble servants, wage slaves under tight control, abandoning their independence for the larger part of their lives.
You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media companies, so they control just about all of the news and information you get to hear. They got you by the balls. They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. Nobody seems to notice. Nobody seems to care. Good, honest, hardworking people, white collar, blue collar, doesn't matter what color shirt you have on. Good, honest, hardworking people continue. These are people of modest means. Continue to elect these rich cocksuckers who don't give a fuck about them. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't care about you at all, at all, at all. Man, you know?
Because music, as an art form, is essentially playful. We say you play the piano. You don't work the piano. Why? Music differs from, say, travel. When you travel, you are trying to get somewhere. One doesn't make the end of a composition the point of the composition. If that were so, the best conductors would be those who played fastest. And there would be composers who wrote only finales. People go to a concert just to hear one crashing chord, because that's the end. Same way in dancing. You don't aim at a particular spot in the room. That's where you should arrive. The whole point of the dancing is the dance.
So again, please subscribe on YouTube, follow the podcast and the YouTube channel, and follow me on X, Born Alchemist, and leave a nice review if you have the time. Now, have you ever heard about a dude called Anaximander? He lived like 500 years before Christ. He's an ancient Greek philosopher, and he did have some groundbreaking ideas in cosmology. And talked about a cylindrical earth. And he also suggested that humans originated from the ocean. And he pioneered cartography and many other things. And the reason I mention this is because we're going to listen to and close this episode with a Nameless Archive track called Anaximander. So enjoy that, and I'll see you in the next one. Freedom is in the mind.